Right. Yes.
I'll call the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Our quorum is present. First order of business would be approval of the minutes from April 13th. 14th, sorry. April 14th. Chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Brainerd moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Members, obviously, we have only one bill on the agenda today. It is a bill that proposes some significant and rather major changes in the way we do things. So I hope we can have a complete and far-ranging discussion of this bill. I want to, before we ask Representative Kalin to describe his bill, I want to invite any members of the audience who are so inclined to feel free to come forward and participate in the discussion. We only have two people that actually have requested to be heard with regard to this bill, but I'm sure there are people present that do have significant interest in this matter, and I would encourage you to share your thoughts with us whenever that becomes possible. So, Representative Kalin, House File 3415.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I would like to move that House File 3415 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance. And, Mr. Chair, members, you should have it, the DE1 amendment that was posted yesterday in your packets. I have one oral amendment to incorporate on line 4.33. On line 4.33, the word commissioner should be commission. And I'd like to incorporate that in the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair. And I will move that amendment with the incorporation.
Duly noted. So Representative Kalin moves adoption of the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which he wishes to have it discussed. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kalin,
the bill is amended. Mr. Soderberg has worked with Mr. Eliff to make sure the appropriation language is accurate, and so I would like to move the A2 amendment, which is just a technical mechanical amendment to make the appropriation work.
So, members, that motion is before us. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Westrum. Mr. Chair, I believe it was the last amendment that raised the appropriation to $1 million from $500,000, right, Representative Kim?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Kalin, to your bill, hopefully in the shape that you want it.
It is indeed, Mr. Chair. And members, I want to thank all members of this committee and the stakeholders here today for their engagement in advance on a bill that I think addresses many of the questions that we have struggled with in my 4 years here, and certainly the last 2 years with the current members of this committee. The Ratepayer Protection Act, House File 3415, has grown out of those conversations with utilities, consumer advocates, ratepayer advocates, and efficiency and environmental advocates in the community. I think there's a broad consensus that our current financial and regulatory structure still does not provide adequate protection for ratepayers, that while we've made great progress on energy policy, the regulatory policy is not yet aligned with that energy policy. The financial structure that we're working under was first adopted in 1907 by other states. Minnesota joined in, you could argue, 1960 or 1974, formally in our statutes, 1974. The rate structure is built off of an age of expansion where capital has been the name of the game for making money for utilities for providing earnings to their shareholders. I think we've heard time and again consternation over riders, rate recovery options. Now there are 20 of them being studied by the Public Utilities Commission that have been enacted by this legislature and legislatures before us. And I wrote at least one of them. I have to go back and look at the 2007 Demand Efficiency Act. I believe that there's only one. There might be a second one in there. But the fact that we have grown to 20 is evidence of the fact that our system is broken, that rate cases and our rate structure is not serving consumers nor the reliable returns that utilities need in order to get moderately priced capital to keep up their system. I want to go back to the 2005 legislative auditor's report on the Conservation Improvement Program, specifically about energy efficiency, that says, studies carried out by three of Minnesota's investor-owned utilities indicate that in 5 to 20 years, cost-effective conservation will have the potential to reduce the state's energy needs by between 10 and 30%. That term cost-effective is the key. In the Big Stone 2 Big Stone 2 certificate of need application, the utility's own data showed that historical performance for energy efficiency costs about a penny a kilowatt hour. But because of the capital model of expansion that we have set, that was set forth starting 103 years ago, that's the primary earnings opportunity for utilities. As a result, our ratepayers are not being well served. You're likely going to hear some concerns about costs and reliability and stability of pricing for energy for businesses. It's a very important concern, a very critical concern that needs to be addressed through a broad and deep stakeholder process at the Public Utilities Commission. You're probably also going to hear a little bit from utilities about the risk of capital becoming more expensive. You may hear a case about the Florida Power and Light that recently, this week or last week, had their credit rating downgraded. So what does that mean for ratepayers if capital becomes more expensive for utilities to access? It's inherently going to make it more expensive to serve the customers, the ratepayers that we represent. There are a couple of policy changes I'll walk through, but the heart of the bill opens a docket at the Public Utilities Commission to go through a formal stakeholder process to look at a 21st century regulatory structure for energy in this state that looks after three main goals: finding the lowest long-term cost options, so the lowest cost for ratepayers, reliable service, and a sustainable business model for utilities that empowers them to provide that lowest cost, reliable service. We have enacted major policy changes on the statutory side as a legislature over the last 5 or 6 years. Not all of us were here for the mercury emissions legislation 3 biennia ago, but that was step one. Step two was the Renewable Electricity Standard. Step three was the Next Generation Energy Act. We have been trying to find the cleanest, cheapest, reliable energy for Minnesota. We need a business model that recognizes that 103 years old should not be the only way that we find, that we create a means to get the cheapest, cleanest, reliable resource. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to walk through the bill briefly. And then, and my hope is that we can hear from our stakeholders and committee members briefly, but as deeply as we can today, about the discussion that I hope will go even more deeply with data-driven decisions at the Public Utilities Commission. So the DE1 amendment as amended, Section 1 is just the title. Section 2, lines 1.12 and 1.13 just update the sections of law that are referred to in the overarching rate mandate, rate regulatory mandate given to the Public Utilities Commission. The language on line 1.14 has been discussed quite a bit, and you'll probably hear some consideration about the term lowest long-term total costs being not fully defined or fully understood yet. The idea here is to, again, provide enough mandate to the Public Utilities Commission to regulate under the energy policy changes that we've made that have started to internalize long-term costs so that we have long-term planning at the lowest cost in favor of the consumers in the state. Section 3 also updates the mandate for the commission and largely mirrors the goal of what I just described in Section 2. Section 4, the main change, Section 4 and Section 5 directly relate to the certificate of need application process. Currently, there is a presumption, it's not a presumption, but currently there is a requirement that applicants model other alternatives to the project that they're proposing. If they're proposing a new power line or a new power plant or other large energy facility that requires a certificate of need, the existing law on bullet 8 in the conservation alternatives on line 2.26 has been structured so that there's a little bit of ambiguity about whether compliance with existing SIP mandates and a utility's existing conservation improvement program goal satisfies the modeling to look at whether conservation could meet the resource need at a lower cost. What we want, I believe, as a committee and as a legislature, is we want the lowest cost option that meets that resource need to be the highest alternative or the highest option for the Public Utilities Commission. So this merely suggests that the applicants have to model other alternative resources. So if a utility's goal is one reducing demand by 1.3% a year, and they model 2%, and it turns out that 2% conservation efforts are cheaper than a new power plant, we want them to do the cheaper alternative providing that it meets that resource need. The change in Section 5 also goes after that same point with the renewable electricity standard. Currently, the Commission cannot issue a certificate of need for a large energy facility if there's a lower cost option on the renewables side. We want to make sure that all options are modeled, not just strict compliance with the renewable electricity standard and no more modeling is necessary. Mm. Section 6 is, you'll probably hear a little bit of consternation about Section 6, and I think that it's something that we should discuss thoroughly. Every applicant in a partnership for a power plant would need to show that they have modeled the lowest cost option under the language in Section 6. So if you have three utilities joining together to develop a new gas-fired power plant, 400-megawatt power plant, all three utilities would have to show that they have, for their own service area, modeled other options that could meet that resource need. Again, we want the lowest cost option to be what's before the Public Utilities Commission. And Section 7 is the study itself. And I'll walk through the timeline and then the substance. It's a stakeholder process that does result in a report. The stakeholder process has to be engaged through a formal docket at the Public Utilities Commission opened on September 1st of this year, with interim reports to this committee and corresponding Senate committees, February 15th of 2011 and February 15th of 2012. If the process determines that there are changes in rules, in protocol or procedures of the Public Utilities Commission that are not serving ratepayers well, none of those suggestions can be adopted without the opportunity for legislative review. It would happen in 2011 and obviously again in 2012. The final report will be due January 15th of 2013. The options for that report, I'll point you to lines 5.5 to 5.9, or 5.8, are to provide recommendations and options for changing the way Minnesota regulates utilities, for utility business models, and for energy policies that achieve the goals of paragraph A that I've already described, actually, and to address the barriers that may inhibit implementation of the changes and strategies to overcome the barriers. We want a wide-ranging discussion of what is necessary to provide the cleanest, cheapest, and reliable electric and gas utility service in Minnesota. And I think we want it away from the political winds of this, of the legislature. We want a data-driven discussion. The substance of the study is to align energy utility regulation with our state's energy policies, with primary emphasis to efficiency and renewables, as is our energy policy for the state, while ensuring lowest total long-term costs, maintaining reliable service, and ensuring a sustainable business model. There are a couple of regulatory issues that are spelled out starting on paragraph B in 4.18. Specifically, financial mechanisms that align a utility's financial interests with efficiency and renewable energy measures and renewable sources as resource options, including but not limited to shared savings models, rate of return mechanisms that provide competitive returns on equity for investments in efficiency and renewables, and something that that Commissioner Glahn, Director Glahn, and I have talked quite a bit about, time of day pricing, clear price signals based on consumption that change during the day. The interim rate issue that we spent quite a bit of time is also one of the things that that the study must include, as well as the frequency and timing of general rate cases. And the third is how the broader regulatory structures and procedures can be amended to allow OES and the PUC to take modeling off of just a presumption that the utilities data is the only data that the PUC must react to. The OES has embarked on this a little bit, but I think we need a deeper process so that we can all trust the data that is driving rate cases, that is driving the discussion about regulatory policy. It is not to say that we inherently distrust utility-driven data, but they are, by their own nature, providing the data to back up their applications. That's what they are doing. We need to have a third-party data source that is reliable and helps us protect ratepayers in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I want to highlight one thing before I wanted to make sure that the committee and the public fully understood the DE amendment. But one thing that I'd like to highlight about the openness of this conversation and stakeholder process and the true open-ended towards getting the lowest cost, cleanest, reliable resource we can. If it is determined by the stakeholder process that providing a business model for the utilities that works to engage in deep energy efficiency, it's the lowest cost resource that protects consumers, that sunsetting the Conservation Improvement Program is critical to the success of protecting ratepayers and having the cleanest, cheapest resource. As the author of the 2007 reforms who cut my teeth on that program, I could support sunsetting or eliminating SIP. I could also see the body bringing forward significant changes to the renewable electricity standard if there are other models that would provide the cleanest, cheapest, reliable electricity to Minnesota. I think we need to have a thorough and open-ended conversation about what's the best direction for the 21st century energy model in Minnesota. And with that, I thank you for your patience for walking through the bill and appreciate your dialogue and ask for your support in the end.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. If it's agreeable to members, we do have two people who have specifically asked to testify. I think they'll give us somewhat differing views of the subject, and I think it might be good to just hear from them before we open it up for discussion from the members, unless there are any questions that members have currently that are compelling. Seeing none, Director Vaughn from the Office of Energy Security.
Mr. Chair, thanks for inviting me down. Chairman Hilty, members, Representative Hilty, Representative Kalin, I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning, and I apologize that given the complexity and length of the bill, I won't be able to be as pithy as you're accustomed to, because I have a number of substantive points I think need to be made that have yet to be made in Representative Kalin's overview of this.
And Mr. Vaughn, before you continue, you do need to identify yourself.
Sorry. I don't know how I forgot that. Bill Vaughn, Deputy Director, Department of Commerce, Director of the Office of Energy Security.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to give a little bit of an overview of an alternative vision to what Representative Kalin has laid out. Go through the bill section by section. I'll try to avoid the line-by-line review, but go over it section by section, and then kind of wrap up with coming back to that overview. And without getting into 103 years of regulatory history, I would call members' attention back to, I think it's the year 1974, which is the year that we instituted statewide regulation of public utilities. Before that, it had been city by city, or groups of cities would get together and regulate utilities, and we had done a much more localized approach to regulation and took on a statewide model for investor-owned utilities in 1973. And so, you know, again, not to mischaracterize what Representative Kalin has done here or to disparage the approach, but I'd characterize it more as trying to fix the 1974 system rather than a fundamental rethink of utility regulation and a rethink of where this industry is headed and what the future might hold for this industry. Instead, we are taking as an assumption that we'll continue with the vertically integrated, rate-regulated model that we've had essentially since 1974 in Minnesota. So, again, by that standpoint, I could characterize this as we're trying to put Band-Aids on a system that Mr. Kalin characterized as broken, but we're just trying to put Band-Aids on it to try to reconcile through our regulatory processes and procedures what we've put in place in energy in terms of our environmental goals. So trying to reconcile the renewable energy standard, energy efficiency standard, the greenhouse gas reductions goals, and all the other social goals that we've put on our energy utilities and try to reconcile that with our rate-making mechanism. I think that's perhaps a fairer characterization of what Representative Kalin's attempting with this effort than strictly a ratepayer protection, consumer protection standard. So, you know, I guess I would take issue with that at the end of the day we're going to end up protecting the ratepayers. We may well accomplish the goal of realigning utility incentives with our environmental goals, but I'm not sure at the end of the day we'll, strictly speaking, protect ratepayers, because I don't see a specific section of the bill that gets to that, that gets to protecting the ratepayer so much as and again, I would characterize what Mr. Kalin has done in terms of outreach to the stakeholder community, and I'd invite you to contradict me, because I came in late in the process. So Representative Kalin interacted with some of our utilities and some of our environmental community, and then later on brought in ratepayer and consumer advocates when there was a bill that had been drafted. I don't know, is that a fair characterization or oversimplification? Call it an oversimplification. And we'll move on. As opposed to a much different approach, which might be to start with a clean sheet of paper and think ahead of where do we want to end up with? What's the end game? What do we want to see in terms of an energy delivery system? An energy delivery system that maintains, you know, we could come up with all kinds of goals, not too dissimilar from what Representative Kalin has written in here, goals that protect competitiveness of our industry, protect the ratepayer, but also work to pursue our environmental goals. What would that industry look like, rather than assuming that the vertically integrated system we've had since the 1880s would continue unchanged? Could we imagine a much different future and work backward from that? And I would characterize what Representative Kalin has done is taken the status quo, look forward, and see, well, what can we do to tweak the status quo to try to achieve some of the goals that he's laid out here. So that with that overview, I wanted to give some context to my comments on the individual sections. And so section two, the reasonable rate standard, and here this is, from my practice, I'm going back to my life as a consultant and a ratepayer advocate, and I've done that in a number of states across the country. And I have to say that not being a lawyer, but being a ratepayer advocate, that the language we have in Minnesota to protect ratepayers is among the strongest I've seen in the country. The rates shall be just and reasonable, doubts as to reasonableness resolved in favor of the customer, very strong language. And this 216B03 really is the chapter, the section of the chapter that the Public Utilities Commission and we at the OES look toward for the Rosetta Stone, the fundamental guidance of how we do rates in Minnesota. And so you recall the inverted block rate bill that came through this committee some weeks ago. We objected to including any language in that 216B03 section, and there was an amendment to move it to a new section of the bill and to a new section of the statute away from the 216B03, because we were very protective of the language in there, very concerned whenever we're changing those words, because consumer advocates, ratepayer advocates rely heavily on that language as the backstop to maintaining reasonable rates. So the way I read the existing statute, that we have a pretty bright line about rates being just and reasonable and where we should resolve doubts. And then we've carved out a couple of exceptions to that. We say we're trying to pursue energy conservation. We're trying to pursue some of these other social goals that we've written into Chapter 216 B and C. And we carve out exceptions to the reasonable rate statute for that. We use the language to the maximum reasonable extent. Again, I'm not sure what that language means, maximum reasonable. You know, as long as we don't have the highest rates in the country, then number two is good enough. We're well below that, I should hasten to add. So when we have this language, these changes to the statute, I'm concerned that we're doing a couple of things. We're creating more exceptions to the just and reasonable standard, and we're in effect reducing the effectiveness of the off-ramps, for example, we built into the renewable energy standard. So by saying that you know, this chapter 216C, chapter 216H, where we have say the renewable energy standard, and I do appreciate that Representative Kaler has made changes in response to some of my suggestions, and some of this language in here is different from his earlier bill, and I appreciate that. But I'm still concerned that we write in chapter 216B, chapter 216C is the energy efficiency standard for the most part. Chapter 216H is the greenhouse gas reduction goals. So, you know, would the commission read this as saying that a carbon tax would be appropriate for, and perhaps that's an extreme example, but what would be permissible in rate making to pursue the goals in these chapters as long as it's underneath the maximum reasonable extent? So I have a lot of concerns about the location of this language, but just the principle we're getting away from that just and reasonable standard in order to pursue what may be laudable goals. So moving on, so section three, the state energy goals, again.
Director Vaughn, before you move on, since we use the term just and reasonable a number of times here, doesn't reasonable in this context imply reasonable in terms of the status quo? I mean, aren't we saying that for something to be judged reasonable, it has to be judged reasonable in the context of all of our current givens with how rates are determined and how the whole system works?
Well, Mr. Chair, I probably the short answer to your question is yes. You know, there's, again, as I always say, I'm not a lawyer. There's 70, 80 years of case law built up around the Supreme Court cases that put these standards in place. You know, we're always going to look toward the recent past as a standard to judge against, or look toward what other states are doing. You know, what is the price of electricity in Wisconsin might be a standard by which you would judge reasonableness, or the United States on average. So, you know, it probably does imply some adherence to the status quo, and given that there's decades of jurisprudence built up around that, the short answer to your question is probably yes, but I think there's probably a lot more nuance to it than that. If I could...
Sorry for the interruption, please.
No, no problem. Mr. Chair, moving on, state energy goals. Again, I've expressed this concern. To the extent that these items aren't completely redundant from what's already in statute, you know, because we have goals toward energy efficiency goals, renewable energy goals, greenhouse gas reduction goals, already written in elsewhere in Chapter 216's B through H. So it's somewhat redundant, but again, without the benefit of legal training, come to appreciate the concept that legislatures don't legislate for no reason. You don't put stuff in there just because it sends a nice signal. But by putting this in there, there's going to be a temptation to read something into this. And I'm not quite sure. I don't recall your discussion of this particular section, but I assume there's a particular reason why we're defining these as state energy goals in statute, that particular attention needs to be paid to these, perhaps at the expense of other laudable goals that we have. Moving on to Section 4, again, I think Representative Kalin foresaw some of the comments about that I'm going to make, so I won't go and reiterate the stuff he's already preempted. But in some, and again, in my almost weekly role as Cassandra about the lack of investment in our infrastructure and our coming need for more capacity, I'm very concerned at a threshold level of anything that we do that would cause more barriers to be erected around getting facilities permitted and built. So I believe we need more energy facilities. We need to have more transmission facilities, notwithstanding whatever delay could be introduced by putting a higher barriers, or perhaps delay could be introduced by putting more commitment to energy efficiency. Nobody opposes energy efficiency, but just again, this is more to the literal reading of the language here on lines 2.28 and 2.29. You were saying we have to exceed requirements that we have in place in statute. I don't know if you 1.5%, so we're saying that's not good enough to show that you need to build a new facility. 2% was suggested by Representative Kalin. It's not written in here. At what point do you've shown you've exhausted all other opportunities and now you finally get to build? I'm very concerned about when we throw around terms about looking at things from a societal standpoint or a long-term cost standpoint or a total cost standpoint, because these have very specific meanings in the world of rate making. For example, when we look at conservation improvement investments from a societal standpoint, we use a lower discount rate than we do from a utility standpoint. So something that looks like it makes sense from a societal standpoint and gets to the penny or two penny a kilowatt hour that Representative Kalin mentioned, when you go and do the discount rate for a utility standpoint or the ratepayer standpoint, then all of a sudden it doesn't look quite as cost-effective from that perspective. So we throw out these terms and we think this just sounds good. Who's in favor of higher long-term cost? Or who's in favor of not looking at total cost? Or if it's good for society, isn't that good for us all? These have very specific meanings in the rate making context, and I caution their use in statute in that we might push us down into a direction we didn't quite understand, because at the end of the day, some analyst in my office or across the street of the PUC is going to have to put this into practice. So I have a general concern with Section 4 about erecting additional barriers to building what I think are critically needed facilities. Section 5, similar concern. That we're kind of flipped it over, saying that if you show in a proceeding that you're complying with statute, with the renewable energy standard or the energy efficiency standard, that is not sufficient showing for getting the certificate or the permit. Well, then it begs the question, well, what would be what would be a sufficient showing? And so, again, by leaving this open-ended as it is, you're inviting long litigation over these words, and I think it just in the end of the day, just introduces more delay into the process. And then Section 6, and again, Representative Kalin is correct, we had some extended discussion about this section. And again, to oversimplify at the risk of mischaracterizing the discussion, it's centered around the Big Stone 2 case where you had a number of applicants who had pooled their resources to try to build a facility that fell under the jurisdiction of Minnesota's Public Utilities Commission. And there seemed to be some frustration by some stakeholders that we could impose conditions upon Otter Tail Power because they were the local utility and fell under the umbrella of the PUC, but there was some frustration that those same conditions could not be extended, for example, to MDU, Montana Dakota Utility, which is headquartered, if I remember correctly, in Bismarck and does not have any electric service territory in Minnesota. So they were a participant in this project, but fell outside the jurisdiction of the PUC. So if we had a repeat, and again, I could be misreading the language here or misinterpreting it, but if we had a project that was in Minnesota that had a number of applicants who had pooled together to achieve some economies of scale, then we would again be extending our jurisdiction outside the state boundaries if the project included utilities from outside of Minnesota, for example, MDU or one of the Wisconsin utilities. So I think it might potentially raise interstate commerce issues about how far does the reach of our Public Utilities Commission go in trying to have applicants show compliance or any purchasers of a project show compliance with these statutes. Or I guess another extreme example, somebody who isn't a regulated utility at all, some merchant developer or some a non-regulated entity coming in and developing. So I have those concerns about that. And as to the study, I'm back to my big picture overview of, I think it would be a more interesting and more helpful exercise to do some work, blue sky, blank paper work around imagining what our energy future might look like, with all the new technology, particularly information technology that has been introduced in the last 5, 10, 20 years, and seeing if you were to start over, would you build the same vertically integrated system that we have today, or would you have a much different delivery system, much different business model for the energy business? And doing that work, and then working our way backwards, so how can we reconcile what we have today with where we want to be? Just some specific questions about the study as it is. Again, I know at my request, Representative Kalin did make some changes to what is now 4.18 through the end of page 4 anyway, to adjust some of the deliverables or specifics that he wanted out of the study. We did have a long discussion of time of day pricing, and I hope members don't come away with the idea that I support the idea. From the simple observation that, you know, I use myself as an example. I pay about $100 a month as an Xcel Energy electricity customer, and frankly, I'm not going to spend the time and effort to adjust my behavior on time of day pricing. You know, to save $10-$20 a month, it just isn't worth, as committed as I am to the environment, isn't worth the time investment to go and read the meter and see that prices are high and then go and undertake an effort to actively manage my usage by shifting load to, you know. But we could easily have a world where somebody like Google or Johnson Controls here in Minnesota, companies do that all automatically. And you don't necessarily need a time-of-day pricing mechanism to do that. You just have some software, which is now becoming readily available, some hardware, some smart meter, some communication software, where I think we get to the same place, but in a much different path. So I know time-of-day pricing is something that a lot of people have pointed toward as a way of changing consumer behavior. I think that errand is probably not well-directed, that we need a way to bring to bear new technologies to have this done automatically so we, the consumer doesn't have to put in that kind of effort. Again, that might be a philosophical difference, but I caution about being too, again, prescriptive, we decided that was the word, too prescriptive about the measures that the study would do. And one more, or just two more short points. Lines 4.32 and 4.33, I caution writing in the Office of Energy Security. We are a creature of executive order, not a creature of statute, so the Commissioner of Commerce is usually the term of art. And then back to the larger vision, I think this probably does capture what Representative Kalin has in mind in line 4.34, this long-term statewide energy planning vision. Well, I think we have a much different view of what that kind of vision would be. My much more of the, let's find out where the end is and work our way back. And I thought we heard some interesting testimony this morning, Mr. Chair, in the Finance Committee about how at least some stakeholders would like very much a localized, a neighborhood-up vision of energy planning. So, and I think that would be in conflict with this very much a top-down vision. So I think that's a conversation worth having. Do we do energy planning from the ground up, from the neighborhood level, and build upon that? Or we do it statewide or for the whole nation, at least with some bills going through Congress, and impose that vision on down to the street level? So with that, I have a number of concerns, at which you know I'm sure we'll get into, the just the overall cost of the million-dollar study, the result we're going to have, how ratepayers in the end are going to benefit from that. And with that, I think I'll end my remarks.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Glahn, a lot of this that you're describing, Representative Kalin's bill, reminds me of California, where the existing utilities could no longer afford to generate power. They had to go out and purchase power. Because they were purchasing power, the power they were purchasing, the price went up. And I remember co-authoring a bill that had Department of Trade put billboards up in California, moved to Minnesota, occasional whiteout, but never a blackout. It seems like we're going towards having blackouts. I look at England, they're having the same thing. I look at February of 08. We were at 97.5% of capacity. Now we're making it harder to have utilities determine capacity. We're making it harder for utilities to be able to forecast their needs and to be flexible enough to take care of the needs. I know they say we're going to have to start building power plants for need-based generations 3 years ago in order to have them from where they project we're going to be short of power. Is there any concern with you and the Department of Commerce that we might be short of power and this would do nothing but put barriers in getting that power we need, forcing us to buy power from outside sources that would cause power to be purchased to be higher priced, just like California? Any concern there?
Director Glahn?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I would preface this by saying I don't have any evidence that we're in a danger of imminent blackouts or imminent brownouts. The utilities, every occasion I ask them how the next summer looks, how the next winter looks, and I take at their word, their assurances that we're in good shape for the short term. I do have a concern about the longer term that, and California is a good example, where they decided for whatever reason they were going to get away from building new facilities or drove all of the new facilities toward being natural gas burning facilities, and then got caught in a squeeze. And you know, a lot of folks blame Enron and some of the other market players for that. But I would put forward California wouldn't have been in the position to be manipulated by the market players if they had followed a course of making sure there was plenty of excess capacity and basic needs were being met. So I do have that concern about using other states as an example and following the path that has ended in tears in places like California. And so I'm concerned about reliability. I'm concerned about not being in the position where you're subject to being manipulated and you're at the victim of events. But also what ended up happening in California was a crash course in natural gas plant building. So at the worst possible time to be a buyer, you have to go in a crash course of what's available, what can we jam through the permitting process, what can we get up and running by the time summer comes. And a few years ago, back in my consulting days, we were doing some work on Long Island, New York, where they went through a similar exercise where they put 400 megawatts of GE combustion turbines on the ground in a 90-day period to be ready for the summer season, because they had put up, you know, well, it was a long story involving the Shoreham nuclear plant, but you cut off your options and you narrow the scope for action, and you end up either being at the mercy of events or having to spend premium prices to maintain reliability in the face of crash deadlines. I think those are the futures that could happen if you're not looking at all the alternatives being on the table.
Thank you.
Representative Callen, trying to turn Minnesota into a cold California.
Hardly, Mr. Chair. I think that there are a couple of good lessons that we can learn from the California experience that started about 13 or 14 years ago and ended in the Enron disaster. Their response to essentially a broken regulatory structure was one direction. And I think what we need to do is actually have a response that addresses all the possible directions and has this. I mean, my first response, as you were asking the question, Representative Gunther, was to ask for more data that would underpin the basis for your question. What I think we should do is create a space where the response to the question is, what does that question mean? Where are we in terms of reliable service? Where are we in terms of the long-term costs? One of the questions that this committee has not dealt with overtly yet, that I think we will soon, maybe today, is the question of our aging coal fleet. We have coal power plants that are at or beyond their useful life, where we have been pouring a lot of capital into keeping them up. We've dealt with this question on nuclear and decided to keep those plants operating because we need baseload. We need baseload power that we have on the grid today. So the question should be, what are the costs and what are the benefits of keeping that baseload power going by continuing to reinvest in aging infrastructure? Or is there a new direction that we need to go in that can meet that same resource need? And Representative Gunther, I do not have the answer to that question. But it is a question that I believe we need to ask, because if we don't, the description of putting up hundreds of megawatts in 30, 60, 90, 120 days through natural gas, I mean, my understanding is that a dollar increase in natural gas is $100 million a year for taconite plants. I mean, this has incredible impact on the cost of doing business in Minnesota. We need to have a full and rich, robust discussion about how we meet that future need, and the current rate structure won't do it.
Further questions for Mr. Golan? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to take off from Representative Kalin's comments about California, I would submit to the committee that 12 or 13 years ago was not the seeds of their problem. The seeds of the California problem were actually sowed back in the late 70s with the first energy crisis and some of the tack they took, where they actually forced the utility to dismantle a huge nuclear power plant and some other things that they did. When my father was there in the 1980s, I remember we would talk and he'd just shake his head, having come from the coal fields of Pennsylvania, shake his head at some of the things California was doing and trying to make it up with windmills. It was an astonishing thing, and I would submit that they are not at the end of their problems. They're only on the path, just a little ways ahead of us, at 12% unemployment and 15 cents a kilowatt hour on their average retail rate. Probably a path we don't want to follow too far down, but it's very instructional for us as we contemplate what we're doing. And I just want to say thank you for being willing to engage in this discussion, because you know we've had some of this discussion in the lunchroom and in the halls and so on about where would we go, what would we do differently if it was 100 years ago? Mm-hmm. Would we do anything differently? It's not a given that we would naturally just do things differently, but would we? It would be nice to know that. So we're going to have a nice conversation about this. I think this bill's a good starting point, a good catalyst for that. But in your opening comments, and I'd love to talk about all the technical stuff and the history and so on, but maybe to get down to the bedrock of the discussion here about where we want it to go. When we're talking about vision, we're talking basically about philosophy and about the way we see the world. You made a comment about you think we're past an era of predictable growth in demand. And perhaps there's something like this. I'm paraphrasing because I just was struck by the comment. And if you maybe give us some direction on what you're thinking with this bill, it might give us some help us know how to react to it and how to shape our thoughts. The gist was you think we're past an era of predictable growth in demand where we just forecasted growth and built for it. And maybe we ought to be planning for more conservation and efficiency. And maybe there's a new day coming in the way we think and use energy. Do you recall that comment? And because I think that gets at the very bedrock of the discussion and the diversion of ideas on how we form this discussion.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beard. I'm not sure I would have that I said it exactly that way. And if
you
I
didn't.
And I appreciate the opportunity to engage in sort of the heart, the kernel of what we're after here. I think there's a difference between growth and sort of the capital system that, you know, in the United States, the we have been living under the, it was the 1907, the what became the 1907 state regulation, but really most of us associate with the Rural Electrification Act, where the challenge was to reach the last mile. It was really the last 10 miles, then the last two, then the last mile. And I actually live in telephone service. I still can't get DSL because we literally live just beyond the last mile of the capacity on that system. Well, we've grown to the last mile on electricity. Whether demand continues to go up a little bit, it's not going to go up like it did until about the 70s. And, you know, then slowed, but continued to grow from there. My concern is less about growth in demand than it is, let me start with what I think the growth that we're after is, I think, productivity and economic health, economic vitality. The question is, are we providing the electricity needed for that kind of vitality at the lowest cost? And electricity is not just you flip the switch and the lights come on, it's do they come on every time? Does the motor power up and work at the same power output all the time so you can rely on that? What I think we have not yet done is taken the no-holds-barred approach about how much efficiency are we getting? And is our current model actually allowing the utilities to engage in deep energy efficiency? Things like implementing the smart grid, where it's not utilities making the question, but essentially just, you know, flipping the settings on an iPhone or on a website so in a smart grid world that arbitrage is made for us based on what we want. And, you know, but is that a vision that we can all live with? We need to have that discussion. What I would like to see us do is not approach from a presumption of we need more facilities just because we think we need more facilities, but have a data-driven discussion about how do we meet the energy needs of the future, given if there's robust economic activity and vitality. How do we meet the needs that the economy, for energy that the economy presents to us? If we can do it through no-holds-barred, deep conservation, energy efficiency, innovation that is still cheaper than new plants, then we should do it that way. If we can come up with a cleaner nuclear power plant that that addresses storage issues and safety concerns and is cost-effective, we should do that. I think that all the options should be on the table. And out of political necessity, to be honest to my peers, we don't discuss all the options. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about nuclear, I'm talking about everything. But I think we need a space where it's free and open to discuss all the options of what our future looks like that may include facility growth. It may include essentially filling in brownfields, you know, to use the coal, to look at those coal plants. But we have to have that discussion. We have to talk about how do we do it at lowest cost.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just a note. There is, I think, we still didn't talk about future growth and whether there's an expectation for it. Because of the timelines that are involved in planning structures of this size or reacting, I think We're in a crunch right now where we have no growth. And I think in a few years, we'll probably look back and think it was probably providential that we had time to come up for air, because Lord knows around this place, we keep moving the goal line on the companies we charge with accomplishing these things and changing expectations. And I think until we get that out of our system and settle down a little bit, it's going to be hard to have a discussion like you're talking about, but it's one I think we do need to have. I'm convinced that the current struggle that we're having right now, if we were having, continuing to have 3 and 4% GDP growth, we'd be in a world of hurt. Because we have had, just before the recession hit, a couple of days there where we were at capacity in the system in the upper Midwest. That concerned some of us a great deal. Now that everybody stepped back 15% or so, we got some breathing room. The struggle we're having right now, I'd submit to you, is probably self-inflicted, the result of, I think, of us having these diverging worldviews about whether we even have a right or an obligation to our next generation to continue to grow, to continue to be prosperous, and how that all works. Again, I hark back to your crash course, Mr. Chairman, that you started us off with 2 years
ago. I was just about to bring that up.
I thought you were.
Only a year and a half after I said I thought this was an appropriate context for a discussion about our energy future, we actually seem to be having one.
Good. Well, with that, I'll withhold the rest of my comments. I do have some technical questions, but I know that someone else wants to testify before we're done with committee today, so I'll withhold a few comments, questions.
Just one thing.
Sure.
About the crash course and that discussion. If you recall the discussion of growth and prosperity, I think that it was a point that needs careful thought, whether the link between growth and prosperity is what we have always assumed that it has been. I think it's possible to envision an economic and an energy future that has plenty of prosperity that does not necessarily depend on just doing more and more of what we've been doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think that the good doctor's assertion was that prosperity was connected more directly to surplus production, not necessarily more production. And right. I think therein is part of the key to the discussion we need to have.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Director Klein.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me with a closing comment here. I listened carefully to Representative Kalin's answer to Representative Beard's questions about all options being on the table, looking at everything, and I can't say I disagree with that. Unfortunately, looking at the text of the bill, mm-hmm. I think he's begged the question. He's assumed the answer in the way he's framed the issue, and the answer presumes that we're just, for whatever reason, we're just not trying hard enough on this energy efficiency and renewable energy, and that's where the answer lies. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll yield the table.
Mr. Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Carl Nelson, and I work for Center for Energy and Environment. If I may, my comments are considerably more brief and perhaps less sweeping than the commissioners. I'll try to be concise. I'm here to speak in support of Representative Kalin's bill. The Center for Energy and Environment has been working on energy efficiency, advocating, researching, and implementing energy efficiency programs for 30 years. And although our philosophy and approach to energy is quite pragmatic, I think that our experience with energy efficiency has been that it is a way to achieve multiple policy goals simultaneously with no compromise. If you're for lower energy bills, energy efficiency, cost-effective energy efficiency can be the way to get there. If you're for reducing carbon emissions energy efficiency can be the way to get there. If you're for helping ratepayers to pay less on their energy bills, energy efficiency can be a way to get there. So by having a bill that promotes energy efficiency, it is appropriately one of the most important policy goals for the state, and we support the furthering of energy efficiency policy through this bill. I have a couple comments specific to the study. I think that the study has three major benefits. One, it is useful to initiate this process that will help to look at ways that we can meet or exceed both the SIP 1.5% goal and the renewable energy standard. It can help look at how we can minimize the rate impacts of doing so through having the study, and also it can help ensure the financial viability of utilities. The other thing about this bill and the study that I think is worth pointing out and important is the stakeholder process that is part of how the study would be conducted. That stakeholder process, I think, is extremely important because the current SIP statutes, the current SIP policies that we have, were very carefully constructed and involved input from a lot of stakeholders. And so as we look at, you know, how we can change that and improve on that, it's important to have those stakeholders at the table as we look at the parameters of the study and what we actually want to accomplish in some more detail with that study. We have made a tremendous amount of progress with SIP as well, with our SIP policy. So having that in the context of a stakeholder process can ensure that we keep that momentum going and not slow down the accomplishments that we've already had. So with that, that concludes my remarks. And again, we support this bill.
Questions for Mr. Nelson, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson talked about the ratepayers having to pay less on their bill. Would that be your impression of this act as well, the Ratepayer Protection Act should infer the ratepayers would pay less on their bill?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom. We support cost-effective energy efficiency, and by definition, if cost-effective energy efficiency is pursued, ratepayers will pay less for the same amount of services.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is the right time to do it, but it spurred a question I had when Deputy Glahn was here, relating to rates, and I'll just ask it, and maybe he can come back at some point and answer the question. But he talked about the rate, the discount rate we give when you're factoring it in for utilities versus society. And Mr. Nelson jogged my memory on that issue. I'd like to have a little more discussion on the difference when we have a chance.
Further questions for Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin?
Just one. I can't answer Representative Westrom's question thoroughly. What I can do, Representative Westrom, is point you to the 2005 Legislative Auditor's Report, because the cost benefit analysis discussion is pretty well laid out in terms that you and I can understand. And it was very helpful for me to read and reread it over the years. So. You know, if we don't get that addressed here, this cost benefit and cost effectiveness test are really, really critical when talking about the lowest cost to ratepayers. Urge folks to take a look at it, and I can make sure that that Mr. Pomeroy has the link to it and sends it out if anyone is interested in knowing and getting it. It's easy to find.
Baddies. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to get my mind around a comment Mr. Nelson concluded with, that when it comes to energy efficiency, the less we use, the less we're going to pay, or the less the rate would be. And I'm trying to think about the enormous fixed cost of running the infrastructure we have, and, of course, their rate of return regulated. And if we use less of it, if we make them sell us less of a product, wouldn't the unit cost necessarily go up somewhat? Not directly related to the amount we're not using, but I'm struggling here to think about how that defends the ratepayer. And then I have a comment beyond that, or another question, but I'm struggling to get how ratepayers are protected because we mandate efficiency.
Mr. Nelson, before you respond to that, I just wanted to mention to members, it's my intention with this bill to lay the bill over today. I think that we have a bill that is prepared to advance. I'm not interested in sending a bill out of this committee that has questions hanging. And I know that it was Representative Kalins and Townsend putting the work that he has into this bill and bringing it forward that it foster a discussion about an energy future in this state and how we can protect not only ratepayers but also the utilities that provide that energy that is vital to all of us. So, well, I believe Representative Wester, well, go ahead.
Just to that point, Mr. Chair, would the disposition or plan for the bill, is this more like an interim hearing or an after deadline hearing? Then are we saying 2 weeks we'll be back with a fix-up bill, or is it more just to have a discussion like we're having and this bill probably won't go to the floor?
Well, Representative Westrum, I think there's a lot that needs to occur for the bill to be ready for the floor. You know, in part, I don't think there's much sense in bringing a bill to the floor that is not going to advance in the Senate, so we kind of want to see what's happening there. I wouldn't rule out any possibilities at this time. I just, you know, would restate that it's not my intention to send a bill out of this committee that we're not satisfied is thoroughly vetted.
Mr. Nelson. You remember the question?
I do, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard. I think that you raise an interesting theoretical point, and that indeed it could be the case that energy efficiency, if we got to an extreme amount of energy efficiency, could be displacing, you know, some lower cost generation, particularly for base load where you have high fixed costs and low variable costs. But as a practical matter, I think we're very far from being at that point for a couple of reasons. Number one, the growth rate historically has been greater than or right around 1.5% per year. No utilities are yet even at 1.5% per year of savings. So in the next, you know, triennial plan period, the next 3 years, we're in no danger of exceeding the historical growth rate. Now, as you know, we're in a recession or coming out of a recession, you know, that individual years may differ, but you know, as a practical matter, I don't think we're in danger of you know, saving more than our historical growth rate right now. As we start to get beyond that amount, then you're starting to displace energy that we don't have to build, and but that energy is dispatched in the order of its cost. So the highest cost resources are the ones that last come online, and those would come down. And so that is, you know, you're going to be displacing those higher cost resources first, the ones with the lower fixed costs, the highest variable costs, the greatest fuel costs. But I don't think that we're even at the point where, you know, we're past the historical growth rate right now in our savings.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beard and I have had some discussions about the utility financial model, economic model, is we think of it and we talk about it as commodity, but it's think about the corn bins that I pass all the time. That even the corn that's sitting there standing can be held and waited for a market price that's favorable. Energy, electricity specifically, is a lot, doesn't work that way. But I also think about the another farm experience that we've had, which is with pesticides, that we've used fewer and fewer pesticides, higher concentration, better application, more efficient use of that pesticide, that the cost per unit of the pesticide has gone up, but the total cost to a farmer has gone down. And I know that Representative Magnus is shaking his head because overall, because we passed, in some cases we have passed that point at which it costs more overall. But the question is, what's the total bottom line cost to keep the lights on, to keep the motors running, and it's that bill that matters to ratepayers, commercial, industrial, or residential?
Representative Beard.
And we have, Mr. Chairman, we've had this discussion in fits and starts because we can never have a couple hours in an adult beverage just to keep it going for as long as it needs to go. But just to be clear, I don't necessarily agree that electricity has become a service. I think it actually is a product that's produced on the moment for consumption by people who are actually should be well-educated users, and as long as they're connected to a unit price, they're quite capable of taking care of their own efficiency. The pesticide thing is a great analogy in that it illustrates my point that electricity and pesticides are apples and grapefruits, or apples and fence posts, for instance. They're not even the same, but it is a great discussion to have. I was shaking my head, and I thought you were going to take up on the least cost resource is always replaced, or the most highest cost is always replaced first, because it's not. We mandate solar and wind. When they're available, the utilities have to take them, so they end up backing off, admittedly, gas if they can. But, you know, whenever we take coal, which is one of the lowest cost resources, and we start ramping it up and ramping it down, we drive the maintenance costs of that coal through the roof until it's no longer 1.8 cents. It's something, a number significantly higher, because all of a sudden a 36-month running time with no shutdowns becomes much less because of thermal expansion, contraction, all the other stuff that I don't want to bore you with today. However, when we start monkeying with stuff, like I said, a lot of the stuff we're starting with now is self-inflicted because of mandates. The utilities that produce this stuff can't necessarily turn off the highest cost stuff first because we said otherwise. And that's part of the problem we're having with now mandating that they not sell us the stuff that we're telling them they have to buy.
And Mr. Chair, my desire is not to dominate the conversation, but just to highlight one of the open-ended approaches about the study. If we do a full, robust modeling of what that world looks like without an RES and without a SIP, but with a financial structure that essentially is a loading order, lowest cost resource first, lowest cost cleanest resource first, I think it's one of the things that would be very useful for this committee in the future to see and hear about what are the true options that are as bizarre, crazy as, you know, throwing every noodle at the wall, data-driven, and seeing what sticks. Well, you may very well be right. You also have to be open to the fact you may very well be wrong, but we, you know.
Although he clearly doesn't expect to be.
But I'm willing to risk it. It'd be a great discussion.
Director Vaughn, did you wish to respond to?
Mr. Chair, I did. Representative Westrom directed one of his questions toward me, and I hesitate coming up a little bit because I think I might muddy the waters more than provide clarity. But you know, there's some fine distinctions to be made here, in that we talk about how energy efficiency is the lowest cost resource, and I think people somehow mistake that for it being a zero cost or a negative cost resource. So, and it's probably a fair observation, no matter what you do, rates are going up.
So when we do energy efficiency in the scale we're doing now, where it's hundreds of millions of dollars in direct cost, tens of millions of dollars in financial incentives and other costs, that hits a ratepayer's bill. And they see their bill going up, and we have, with the 20 riders, we have a line item for that. And somebody sees that item ballooning and are going, you know, wait a minute, I was told this was going to reduce rates. Well, in a very narrow sense, it doesn't. It increases their rates. Some of it's the front loading of those costs versus other approaches. But folks might make an argument, oh, well, you should have seen how much it would have gone up had we built a new coal plant or something like that. But as a point of fact, no matter what you do, it's going to have costs. Those costs are going to be passed on to ratepayers. Ratepayers are going to notice that on their bills. So I just want to caution folks when we say, okay, instead of building a new power plant, we're going to do energy efficiency and that'll reduce rates. It may or may not be true, because it is apples to fence posts, trying to compare the two. It may or may not be true that it reduced it lower than it otherwise been, but make no mistake, the rates are going up. So I did want to make that distinction there, Mr. Chair.
Members, perhaps it would be appropriate at this time to ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to contribute to this discussion. Mr. Franklin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Franklin, Energy Policy Director at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll be very brief. A lot of the concerns I was planning to raise have been raised already. We represent 2,400 business customers across the state of Minnesota, which actually ironically puts me in the awkward position of raising concerns of the Ratepayer Protection Act on behalf of ratepayers, or at least as drafted. Now, I've shared a lot of these concerns with Representative Kalin privately, but I do want them on the record, and I will focus on the study. And I think if business ratepayers had been asked to design a study, we would start by taking a comprehensive look at the net costs and the drivers of those costs of existing policies and policy choices and choices made by the PUC. And I think customers would, I've testified to this before, I think customers would insist on that impact analysis being included in the sort of overall view of where we're at, the yardstick, if you will. And then the concern, as I raised with Representative Kalin, and I'll be brief, is not necessarily with what else is in the study, although I do share some of Director Glahn's concerns, but what's not in it. And what's not in the study is a primary focus on ensuring that Minnesota's electric rates and reliability remains a competitive reason to do business in the state of Minnesota for the future. We think that a valuable addition to the Ratepayer Protection Act would be some language, and I don't know exactly how I would characterize it, but some language right away in the study that would focus the outcome on how do we make Minnesota a competitive place to buy electricity for the next 10, 20, 50 years. And our fear would be that this would be a little repetitive to echo Director Glahn, that the study sort of puts the cart before the horse a little bit by sort of saying, take what we've told you to do as the state, focus especially on conservation, figure out how best to compensate utilities for it, and then report back. And I know that's not what Representative Kalin's trying to do. He said it publicly and privately, but our concern is that's what the study would yield and would fail to address this concern over competitiveness. And so, to sum up, business ratepayers in the chamber would be interested, even enthusiastic, about participating in a study much like the one Director Glahn mentioned, which would be to sort of take that blank piece of paper and ask how should we regulate the electric industry heading forward and sort of start from scratch. And I guess we're not convinced that the bill as it's currently drafted does that, but I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Franklin? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, just wondering, have any other states undertaken this effort to do a comprehensive study as you have indicated, and if not, because I think it would be a good idea. You know, we talk about zero-based budgeting. We talk about redefining or looking at new structures, new ways of doing things, and many times we just tweak what we currently have, but to look at doing something in a totally different way, in a new way, that does, I think, need to be studied. And so I'm just wondering, do you know of any other states that have undertaken this effort?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, no, I'm afraid I'm not. I don't know. Representative Kalin was nodding his head, maybe, but I'm not aware of any such study, but perhaps Minnesota would be the first. I'm not aware.
Representative Kalin?
Mr. Chair, I had an off-the-record conversation with a utility employee, not a lobbyist, but a senior resource manager. I think that's the title, or his portfolio, who suggested Colorado may have done a limited version of the study, and I had asked for that information and have not been able to track it down.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know exactly how to make this a simple question. It's for you, Mr. Franklin, as well as Director Glenn. This idea of a blank slate study in which we would look at how we regulate. You know, I would just maintain that I think theoretically and academically you can talk about a blank slate study in terms of doing a brainstorming session, but there are assumptions. We are making, I mean, if you do agree that Representative Kalin is making some assumptions about the validity of the policy we put in place in the last 4 years to address renewables and conservation and efficiency and those roles both economically and socially and our vision of the future, I would say whatever blank slate you start for, you will have assumptions, and I think clarifying those assumptions is critical to any study we do, and I think that's part of what this model is intended to do, is allow us the opportunity to clarify our assumptions in building models. And I just don't think it's realistic to say we could abstract from the RES and, you know, our goals with energy efficiency in terms of building that model. So it's as much a philosophical question as anything, but I think, you know, I think that you will be making assumptions when you do your study on competitiveness, and I might want to challenge some of those assumptions.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brainard, I agree. As you phrased your comment, I think I realize that I myself made an assumption, which is that the state is interested in making sure that we have a competitive system. And so I agree with what you said. I agree with your comment. I think there are some things specifically in the study that shared with Representative Kalin, the specifics like shared savings models, rate of return mechanisms, time of day. My question would be, do we put those in the directive to the PUC, or do we ask a more open-ended question around some of the assumptions you said that assume we want a competitive system, we want to meet our environmental goals, and we want to do so at the lowest possible cost? And I think a study that was a little more, maybe blank slate's the wrong characterization, but something that's a little blanker may be preferable.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Brainard.
Just even a further clarification. I don't want to give the impression I'm not interested in our state having a competitive delivery of energy or cost to the ratepayer, but what defines competitiveness becomes a question, too. How broadly you look at costs and how long range you look at costs and what your comparison, you know, structures are. So I just would say, let's leave that. I mean, I'm willing to engage that, and I think Representative Kalin is too, and I don't think the study excludes that in terms of the modeling proposed.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for committee members, this is a question I think for all members. Mr. Franklin and I have had some discussion about some language that could provide a little bit of and it's not comfort, because I don't think it's actually just about comfort. It's about ensuring that this discussion of net benefits and net expenses or net costs to our policy options are part of that discussion and the impact on ratepayers. That's the whole goal here. But I think even broader, one of the out of a discussion last week, I think it was Director Glahn who suggested that we could actually cut off the study on line 4.10, the language of being just the total long-term cost, reliable service, and sustainable business model, whether or not that was a specific approach, a sort of, you know, blue sky, blank slate. And my concern was, for this committee and myself as a legislator and a steward of our dollars, that we need to have some guideposts along the way that are more than just an open discussion, because we want outcomes. We want guidance to the legislature that's data-driven, that has a good sense of what the consensus could be. And so when we revisit the bill, obviously the language study, the study language will need a little bit more work, but I ask for your help in figuring out how to provide that channel, as it were. Not a single rope or a thing, you know, that we have to tie ourselves to, but enough guidelines for the conversation to be useful, for the PUC staff to have guidelines for the discussion. I don't want us to assess ratepayers $1 million, up to $1 million, and not have outcomes that are worthwhile, that other states can point to Minnesota, as Representative Welty asked, and say they have provided a good model. They're leaders, again, in a different vision of how we can do this to protect people.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sort of to this point about a study that we may do, and I remember we received a copy of a study that was just recently done looking at a number of different models of how we can put together an energy portfolio to meet our future needs. And it looked at nuclear, and it looked at coal, looked at renewables, and a number of things. And so I'm just wondering, some of this information is already out there, and as I looked at the cost, and you're asking for $1 million to do a comprehensive study, I'm just wondering how you arrived at that number, and if there's a way that we could do a more comprehensive study for fewer dollars.
Representative Galen.
Mr. Chair, I think the best answer for you, Representative Welty, is shuttle diplomacy. The bill has largely been crafted through shuttle diplomacy rather than a single stakeholder meeting and process. And so there was a feeling looking at previous studies and previous work that's been done that the original $500,000 was not quite enough, and so providing a ceiling of $1 million but not a floor or a fixed number that we want to, especially considering it'll be a 27-month process, to have the resources to do the modeling as well as the staffing of the stakeholder group to get something that's worthwhile.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, the 27-month process that you put in place, I thought that was pretty extensive. Maybe we need it, and it's going to be, if you do a comprehensive study, you're going to need some time to look at all these factors and have proper entities weigh in and then adjust from there. But I guess, was this a recommendation from the Public Utilities Commission that's how long that they're estimating that this process would take, or just where? I'm just trying to, I'm looking for the background as to how you got to the terms and the conditions of your study.
Representative Galen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This concern about the timeline came up actually at a larger stakeholder meeting, about 25 or 30 advocates in the room, something like that, last week, and some real concern about an original deadline of January or February of 2012. And I think the target is for it to be useful to the PUC for their internal workings, but really it's a legislature that sets energy policy and regulatory policy. So we have to find the appropriate sweet spot in length of time and expense, and I'm open to guidance from members of this committee or the public.
Members, if there are no further questions for Mr. Franklin, I'd again like to offer the invitation of any members of the audience that wish to comment at this time.
Mr. Chair, committee. Kristen Eddy Tollefson. Since you've made such a generous open invitation, I do have some thoughts I'd like to share. After about 15 years in this arena, I have been talking mostly for my own sanity to people under 25. And I work specifically with a new cooperative called Cooperative Energy Futures that is working with communities to to do low-cost energy efficiency and some self-organizing around opportunities for savings and energy efficiency. And so that's the perspective that I'm going to take here. These young people created this co-op because they believe that the economic future that they have depends very much on our rebaselining our economy on efficiency. And the last time I was before this committee, I was speaking to the question of the baseload study. And asking the question, I left you with two questions. What is beyond business as usual, and what are the new models, and what are the new tools that we might need? And so I'm very interested in Representative Kalin's bill and in the discussion you're having, and that it's you intend it to be a deep and thorough discussion. And it seems very critical to have an opportunity to examine these things more thoroughly. One question that I want to bring up as I listen to the discussion moving forward is there's a fundamental assumption, as long as we're speaking about those, about who the ratepayer is. We talk about the ratepayer and the utility. And I would submit that who the ratepayer has been, along with the opportunities for how we deliver and create energy, is changing significantly. And I would invite you to think about the definition that we use of ratepayer. And we talk generally about ratepayers as requiring protection. And I think that's a very critical piece of it. And there's also another thing that I think that ratepayers are going to increasingly need. And I think that the Public Utilities Commission and the I hope that the agencies and OES and legislature can play a role in what Dr. Amin, this is our guru of smart grid, I'm sure you know, calls the essential factor for a smart grid future, which is the empowered consumer. And so I would suggest that our experience in cooperative energy futures is that ratepayers, customers need not only protection but opportunities for meaningful participation in the energy system. EPRI also agrees, the Energy Research Institute, when it looked at its stakeholder process in 2001 for what a 21st energy system would look like, it said one of the essential ingredients of that is the participation of all the sectors. And so as we go forward, talking and thinking about this, as you are doing so well, I would invite us to consider this broader definition of ratepayer for the future. In cooperative energy futures, one of the pieces that we're that we're looking at is how we're supposed to be a cooperative that either is service or product oriented, and we're finding that that's impossible because we see that the services that we provide to the communities and the neighborhoods to increase their energy efficiency also makes them producers of energy services such as demand-side management, such as direct energy savings, and such as potential green credits for themselves or their utilities. There's another thing that we find, and that is people very much want to work with their utilities on these kinds of opportunities. And so a transformation to a 21st energy future is as much about shifting from the one-way energy service delivery model that we have, where we have a utility delivering services to a consumer, to a two-way system, which is the only way that we can really optimize all these new technologies that we have and the opportunities for efficiency. So as you go forward with this discussion, I invite you to kind of put that into the pot and shake it, and also to suggest that that this forum that you're searching for is the thing that, after, again, 15 years in this arena, I think that is absolutely the critical thing that we've been needing for many years, which is a table, a platform in which to discuss what should Minnesota's energy future business, what is the business model, what are the business models, and how do we put those together so that Minnesota's energy future can go forward and be really address these fundamental questions of growth and sustainability that you've been discussing. You know, maybe it's a study, maybe it's a roundtable. You know, but I commend you for this discussion, and thank you very much for your gracious invitation to speak.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Ivy Tolleson? Seeing none, thank you. Director Guan, did you want one more shot here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Breinert directed one of her questions to me, and I did want to respond to her question. And it actually ties in quite well with the last testifier, in that I don't actually disagree with what she was saying about the need to make the system more interactive. And back to Representative Breinert's question about I'm here to defend the clean sheet of paper and the blue sky thing. You're exactly right. And I think this was to your question, Mr. Chair, earlier in the proceedings about the assumptions that we're bringing to the discussion. Now, I read assumptions, whether he intended those to be in there or not. I read assumptions or a premise into the bill that Representative Kalin wrote that for some reason we were not fully utilizing energy efficiency, renewable energy, and we needed to readjust the dial or tweak something to unleash this pent-up resource. And I think I made it clear the bias I brought in, which was that we've woefully underinvested in our energy infrastructure, whether it's generating plants or transmission lines. And that was the perspective I brought to it, that we have way too little of the hardware involved. And so in throwing out the idea of the clean sheet of paper, or the blue sky, however you want to characterize it, I want to get past those biases, and those assumptions are all going to come out in whatever process we're going to use. But my concern is starting with this 1974 system and tweaking the dial here or ratcheting up something over here, that we're all going to end up defending our turf. You know, so I heard the last speaker, and I very much agree with the interactivity. But then somebody's going to say we should do time of day pricing, and then I got to say, well, no, that's not the right way to do it. And so, by starting so close to where we are today, and just let's take where we are today and tweak it a little bit, we're going to each be defending our turf. I want to jump ahead 20, 30, 50 years to a different place where the biases are going to come out, the assumptions are going to come out, but we can not be spending effort defending the status quo because each of us has a stake in part of it. So that's why I suggest the clean sheet of paper. But again, because I can't help myself, but I think the approach that we've been taking in this area, at least dating back to 1994, if not farther than that, is we take the current system and then we graft something else on, the energy efficiency, then we graft on the renewable energy standard, and we graft on greenhouse gas reductions without rethinking the underlying system. And the result is higher rates. You know, you just keep adding, and not rethinking, and the result is higher rates. And so that's why I'm hoping to have a different discussion where we take a look at what we're trying to accomplish and different means, and then maybe we could end up a system that does overall lower costs. But I'm concerned by turning the dial or turning a ratchet, we're just going to end up with higher rates and not get any closer to the goals that we all share. But that's my perspective.
Observation, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I appreciate that Director Glahn has done the impossible, which is accusing me of being too conservative in drafting legislation. So I very much appreciate it.
Well, you look forward to it.
Members, I would suggest that a half hour from now or a couple of days from now, when it occurs to you what you wish you had asked, you keep you make a note of that and bring it to the next hearing on this bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. And Representative Weston, final remarks?
Well, I did have a question, Mr. Chair.
Can
I
wait?
I can wait.
We can refine it, and we'll take it up next time. Representative Weston.
The author might have to postpone his next retry because I'll have more questions then, but he won't know about now. So.
This meeting is adjourned.